When it comes to your sales stack, stop tool hopping and start winning with Nux. Simplify your outbound today at nux.ai/salesgravy. That's nooks.ai/salesgravy.
This is the Sales Gravy Podcast. Hi, I'm Jeb Blunt, best-selling author of Fanatical Prospecting, Objections, Sales EQ, and Inked, and I'm here to help you open more doors, close bigger deals, and rock your commission check.
Welcome back to the Sales Gravy Podcast. I'm Jeb Blunt Jr., and today we have the Pitch Guy back in the studio, the author of Pitch. You can see the book behind him if you're watching us on YouTube. Mr. Danny Fontaine, one of my favorite interviews of 2025, told some incredible stories, a great marketing story. You have to go back and listen to it because it just rocked my world. And I wanted to have Danny come back because the mindset that he has around building stories, what he thinks about and how he goes about his process really, really will help sales professionals dive into a better emotional connection when they're actually in the presence of their buyers, rather than doing the dog and pony show and telling people about their company and then going through the PowerPoint slide. So I really look forward to this conversation. But Danny, thank you so much for being here. Welcome back to the Sales Gravy Podcast. And I can't wait to talk about something in just a moment that I hope that you have a good story behind. But Danny, thank you for being here.
No, it's lovely to be back. Thanks for having me. It was we had a lot of fun last time, didn't we?
And he's gotten a wonderful accent, doesn't he? So it just makes the listening experience even better. Like I was emailing with you prior to this, conversation and getting you here, and I appreciate your time. But in your email, I don't think you knew this, but you have this wonderful picture of you standing with long hair, with kind of like a Chris Stapleton hat. In a rustic blue acoustic guitar. What the hell?
No, I didn't realize. So that's my personal Google account picture for some reason. I had no idea people were seeing that. So that's quite funny. But I was in a band, and the band is called Danny Fontaine and the Horns of Fury. And we haven't been around for about 10 years now, but we were 8 people. We made orchestral death ska, kind of prog rock meets Queen meets the Beach Boys meets Real Big Fish, that kind of thing. And the first thing we did as a band before we did any gigs at all was go and take some band photos. And we decided to go and stand in a field. And I dressed as a cowboy with a hat that I'd actually got from Austin, Texas, in South by Southwest 2004, my pride and joy. And I was a weird juxtaposition of an English bloke from up north and wearing a cowboy outfit.
We have the saying down the south that country is countrywide, and I think the country is international wide. That's awesome.
I think so.
What did you? So you had an acoustic guitar in the band, but you used ska and you Queen and big band and Fish and 8 people in a band. But what was your role in that? Like, were you the rhythm guitar? Were you soloing everything? Were you sort of just the funky guy, you know, dance around in the background? Like, what was your role in the 8 person band?
I was the front man. I was the lead singer and the guitarist. And we played hundreds and hundreds of gigs, usually on like a Monday or Tuesday night to a pub with less people in it than there were us on stage. but we had so much fun, and we toured and we did all sorts of things. And my dream was always to be a rock star. That was it. Number one. But then, you know, same old story. I have lots of these stories that go on to say, but then you get married and have kids and you need to make some money. And there you go.
Well, I appreciate your journey. I also wanted to be a rock star. I was I played 2 shows in my life in college to a group of students who could not have cared less what I was doing on stage. And I played with my friend I actually learned how to play bass guitar terribly. And we played Foo Fighters.
Nice.
Terribly. And then I played some Nirvana. Terribly. And I had a really wonderful time. So you doing hundreds of shows as someone who's only done 2 of them in their entire life. And I play guitar in private and usually in a closed door room because I don't want anybody to hear what I've got going on. That's really cool. And I think it helps mold like you as a human being behind the stories that you tell. You've got clearly like, I've read your book and I've read your blog posts, and you reference kind of your start and your how you became who you are today. And it's not a normal journey. And you should go back to our other podcast and listen to it. But now you've got keynotes coming up. You've got world travel that's you know, on your agenda. You are killing it in the training and sales consulting world. And you're working with wonderful, wonderful clients. And I wanted to pick your brain a bit more. So as you're developing and you're really expanding who you are in the field, I think that people should know a little bit more about the uniqueness that you bring to the table. So when you talk about storytelling, you talk about it, but you also storytell while you're storytelling about talking about storytelling. And I think that there's an art and a science to the process that you probably go through. And I know that when I do keynotes, it's not walking up on stage and winging it. That's not how you do that. Mm. And it takes a lot of preparation, but sometimes too much preparation can end up in something that's like anxiety, or you can be a little bit overproduced, or you can be too canned. And the way that you present is very fluid. Walk people through, as a salesperson, as someone who's making a pitch to somebody else, how you sort of build that that smooth aura that allows you to really make connections with other people. I want you to dive into that a little bit more.
So in terms of that specifically, I mean, it is about preparation. And what we can talk about shortly is how you can compose a story, that art and science bit that you talked about. But in terms of the smoothness and the confidence and the relaxed nature, it is preparation. And controversially, I don't believe you can over-prepare. Really, I think that you can try and learn every single word of a script and say it over and over again, and it might become a bit wooden, but it's not about scripts. It's about scripts to begin with, I think, to get everything, to get your story straight. But then it's about doing it out loud as much as possible, and not just out loud in a room, but it's about doing as many pitches and speeches and talks as possible. So when it's a bit like a comedian. Before they go to the big arena, they rehearse their material in all of these small clubs and pubs, and they know what's funny and they know what's working and they know what's not working at all. And it's exactly the same with a business presentation or pitch, keynote speech. You've got to do it to some other people. And you've got to get really comfortable with not every word being right, but the stories that you're telling and the pauses and the enunciation and the little bits of humor and things like that. You know, last time I told you a story about British Rail, I must have told that story 1,000 times. And the first time I told the story was definitely not as good as the way I tell the story now. But because I know it so well, even now, I kind of riff and play and little thoughts come into my mind that goes, you know, in that moment, Danny, this could be funny if you say this right now. And sometimes it isn't, and sometimes it is. And then next time I say that again or I don't. So it is about preparation and rehearsal, but only once you've got that core story down.
I want to kind of do a parallel here. You played in a band. I'm glad I brought this up, and you did hundreds of shows. And that's sort of the same process, right? Like by your 200th show, you have the rhythm, you can riff off of each other, you can do different things within the set, and you change up the songs and, you know, do a cover within a song that you wanted to do. I mean, it can just get kind of weird at 200, but at one, it's a little like we got to just go through the motions to make sure that we're in the same, playing field, same playbook. You know, for me, like, I don't play music with other people. I play music alone. I typically do it behind closed doors. It's, you know, very personal and private to me because I think I have, like, you know, an embarrassment about it. I don't feel like I'm as practiced as I should be to show other people. And I think that pitches can be very much the same, or storytelling can be very much the same. As a salesperson, what I observe a lot is people go into pitches. They have never rehearsed what they were doing in front of anybody else. They maybe did it, you know, privately and maybe in their car. Yeah. And then they go in front of the customer and, like, that's showtime. And I think that there's people want to rehearse in front of other people. I don't think there's a will to not do it. They just are maybe reluctant to because of, like, our egos. So as you have developed in your career, what has given you more confidence to kind of branch out it to calling over a colleague or talking to your spouse or maybe even your children or, you know, just somebody that you know and you trust to say, hey, you're going to have to sit here for 30 minutes while I go through a business pitch and you're not going to be very interested.
And I do it. I still do it. Yeah. Absolutely. All the time. I pitch to my 11-year-old. I pitch to my 19-year-old. Two very different audiences. I pitch to my wife. If no one's around, I pitch to my dog. You know, you've got to do it. And how did I get to that point? Well, it's the same as anything in life. We learn through our experiences. And I've had lots of experiences where I've had a good pitch after I've rehearsed it in front of someone and a bad pitch when I haven't rehearsed it in front of someone. And so it's leaving your ego at the door. And it's the same with you playing music and it's the same with you doing a pitch. If you want to get good at it, then go through the pain before you're, you know, on the stage in Madison Square Gardens. You know, it's better for your kids and your wife to be like, well, you were a little bit awkward and a little bit embarrassed and, you know, but that's okay because we love you. Learning what to change from there before you go onto the big stage. And to your point earlier, I think it's, there's a lot of parallels between music, because with music, when you're practicing with your band in the studio, you can get really, really good at playing the songs. You can have the rhythm, the timing, the intonation, all the rest of it. But when you're on stage, it's about the performance. And it's the performance that's really hard to practice behind closed doors.
That's such an interesting distinction. I was thinking about this in a very, you know, concrete way. I did a training yesterday, and I had someone in the training that was a little more difficult than other people. And, you know, I was doing some performing, as we do as performers. Sort of is natural to me, but I was doing that performing, and that person was sort of seeing the performance, and I think they didn't appreciate it very much. They wanted more of like the hard facts and everything. And, you know, I come across salespeople that often have this sort of inclination to reduce the amount of performing they're doing because they believe that the experience of the people in the room will be better if they just get to the brass tacks and the bullet points and the, you know, just the things that are concrete and they can stand behind more easily than the performance. And then music, you're right. You can be in the studio and that's the time to be doing the bullet points and the practice and the timing and the, you know, and making sure you're doing all the right things. But when you get on stage, it's not about the music necessarily. It's about the performance you give and the experience you give. So what is the difference in your mind between, say, the practice and the performance? What do you kind of psych yourself up with before you get on stage or before you walk into the room and you're doing a pitch? Like, what are those kinds of notes that you're hitting to say, like, okay, I got to trust this and I'm going to go perform?
And you've just said the key thing, trust. And you've got to trust yourself. Once you've rehearsed so many times, you can be in that point where, to your point, you feel like you've over rehearsed. And before you walk in the room, you're going through all of your lines, all through your lines, and you're so nervous because you're like, I can't screw up a single word. And you just want to get it started, but you also want to get it over with. For me, I've had some amazing people on my podcast. One of them was a guy called Robin Dreek, and he's written a load of books, Code of Trust. And he used to recruit spies from Russia and things for the FBI. Amazing stories. But I was asking him the same question, and this is a number of years ago. And he said, you just got to let it go. And I was like, okay. But you got to be in the moment. You've got to forget all of that overthinking in your head. You've got to forget all of that rehearsal stuff. You've done it and you've banked it. And now you're in a different mental frame of mind when you walk in a room because you've got all of these chemicals. Dopamine, adrenaline, all sorts going on, nerves, a whole load of people staring at you. You can't be the same person. And so you don't need to try. You need to breathe and feel confident, let it go, and trust that if you are relaxed, the things that are going to come out of your mouth are just about the things that you had rehearsed before. Because you've got to be in the room, you've got to be in the moment with these people. Because the other mistake I see is people can be very well rehearsed and polished and they will know every single word of their script. But if they get interrupted,
right,
or if they, you know, someone asks a question, or if they forget one word, then they're like, what was the next line? What was the next line? What was the next line? And you go into this spiral and you see people's faces go red or the color drain from them, whichever it is. It's like panic attack territory.
Yeah.
Because you're relying on every single beat being perfect, and it will never be perfect. Usually imperfection is far more perfect anyway, because to your point, some people think, well, it was a bit overproduced, overperformed, and we don't want that either. We're not actors. We are telling genuine stories that we know because we have written.
Mm.
And we got to trust that those stories are going to come out in about the same way as we'd always hoped that they would. And sometimes they can come out even better.
I like the let it go. You're more I play golf, and golf is this like contradictory sport, game, whatever you want to call it. I think it's more of a game, but that's, you know, for y'all to debate in the comments. But when you play golf, the more you try and control it, the less control you actually have.
Right.
and this
exactly.
And when you do speaking or you do pitches or you're in front of lots of people, like I find it easier to talk to like five people. I find it easier to talk to 10,000 people than I find it to talk to five people. I'm trying to control the room. And I think that what I want to learn from you is you've had lots and lots of years of doing this in front of different groups. And you're telling me about this keynote you've got going on in the Netherlands, which is going to be amazing. I'm really excited for you. And you're speaking to an audience that might have a different persona than the people in Kentucky that you are going to go speak to, right? So that's coming up on your list. And they have a different persona. And in the same room as you as a salesperson pitching, like, we know that there are different personas. There are people who are chief financial officers. There are people who are CEOs. Yeah. There are people who are sales leaders. There are people who are technical leaders. Like, they have different ways they go about the process. And I love your authenticity drive to, like, these are stories that you know because you wrote them. And being in the moment, trusting and letting go. But now you're in the room and you feel confident and you feel good. How do you start to read people as you're pitching? How do you start to read the room and go, okay, I know this story and I've got that joke and I think it'll work here? And you start to play jazz a little bit with what's going on.
But
you've got different buyers. So how do you go about that? What is your process of training and teaching people how to be really fluid in that moment?
Well, I think there is a distinction here between a pitch to maybe a group of four or five people that's pre-planned and more of a keynote speech to a room.
Mm.
And if I'm doing a pitch to a C-suite, I will have researched them a lot before. I will know everything about them. I will know their dog's name. I will know what they love, what they hate, what keeps them awake at night. You know, what is their desire? You know, are they choosing us because really they want a successful project because of A, they want a promotion and a pay rise, or B, it's, you know, whatever it is. You've got to know all of these things, and you shape your pitch to try and hit all of the people in those room, in that room. And sometimes, to your earlier point, there are going to be different characters in terms of, this guy just wants snappy numbers. And if you're too elaborate, he's going to, or she's going to turn off and get bored and frustrated. And you take all of that into account. If you're speaking to a whole room of people, you can't do the research. You can get a general feel. So I'm speaking to a group of designers in the Netherlands. So that's two data points. And I'm speaking to a group of realtors in Kentucky. Two very different data points. But I'm still going to make assumptions on what I think might work in Kentucky with a very similar keynote to what might work, I hope, in the Netherlands. And so then, to your point, it is a bit like playing jazz. You've got to be in the room enough and relaxed enough, like I mentioned earlier, so that you're actually taking in what the audience are doing. You're in listening mode, even if it's listening to body language and emotions. It's like visual listening almost, if that makes sense. There's little things that people do. If you say something and it's got a, you know, I wouldn't use a swear word usually right off the bat, but if I said a word that's a bit like, ooh, and that pissed me off, and it gets a laugh from the audience, then I think, oh, maybe further on, there could be a time where I use a slightly stronger word for funniness or impact, and that's okay. Sometimes people look at you like, I can't believe he said pissed me off. Like, it's just, it's, you know, are people laughing? is part of it. Are people engaged? Are people making eye contact with you? Are people starting to get their phones out? And it's taking those cues and learning what to do with them. But I think in any room, it's also really important to make eye contact as well. This is something that I do. This is, you know, I think really bad advice I've heard before is, you know, look at the back of the room just over everyone's heads. And then it just looks like you're looking at the back of a room over everyone's heads. I go around the audience and I, you know, stay on someone for 5 seconds, go to another person for 5 seconds. And it's quite empowering as well. It can help to build your confidence in the moment on stage, because you realize that the person you're looking at, you make them feel a little bit uncomfortable. Not intentionally, of course. You're not trying to make your audience uncomfortable. But it shows that you're not the only one that needs to be nervous here. But the other thing it does is often you lock eyes with someone and they lock eyes back. And it's in that moment that they start nodding and smiling. And it's a bit like you've made that mini emotional connection with them. And they will stay with you now. So how many people in the audience can you do that with during the course of your talk? Because you're making a whole bunch of emotional connections, even with a sea of people.
I think there's a really meta skill that you've just kind of delivered in this podcast that I also find really powerful, even in small groups of people. If it's, you know, six people in a room, and if it's 10,000, if you start making direct eye contact with every single person in that room, as many as you possibly can, even 10,000 you can't, but as many people as you can, it one builds your confidence. And I find that people are apt to want to disagree with you or have a dismissive attitude until you look them in the eyes. And then they have to either choose to be dismissive actively, or they typically choose to fall a little bit more in line with the conversation and nod their heads and start to, like, you know, give you those reactions because they know you're coming back to them. They know that they're on the, they have a little bit of a spotlight on them too. And
you've made them feel special for a second. Right. That's it. Yeah.
I think that as a pitch person and your, what you teach and how you go about storytelling and all of that can be great. But when you get into that room, if you look someone in the eyes, that emotional connection that you are, that's the payoff of your entire book. That's the payoff of your entire, you know, your brand as the pitch guy, is that emotional connection.
Right.
Let's go to another topic, which I've been dying to ask you about, just because I know of your background. And I asked you the question about your picture earlier. Many years in many different industries, doing many different things. Ultimately, you strike me as a man who has a lot of calm confidence. It's not cocky, it's humble. Have a wonderful family that you speak about quite fondly, and you have quite a busy life, but it looks like you are you're in a place of moderate peace. From my perspective. And I think that what I'd love to learn from you is, as you've written this book, as you've gone through storytelling and the process and psychology of it all, and gone through customer experience and UX and UI and all the different industries that you've worked in, and you stumbled into sales, which I stumbling into sales must have been stressful on its own.
And you've
built your business. What drives you to keep the 8 inches or 6 inches or whatever it is right between here, focused on the right things every single day? You know, yes, building pitches is important, but it's hard to do that when you're not thinking correctly or straight. Give us a little bit of, you know, insight into, like, what's driven you to have the career that you've had so far.
You know, it's not always been very smooth. I think I've always been ambitious and I've always over exerted myself. I've been doing a day job and then another job in the nighttime so I can learn how to make my day job into a different job, and then in a band and a dad, and, you know, always, always hustling, I suppose you would say. And, you know, it got to a point in my late 20s when I basically had a breakdown and my body just said no. And I had huge panic attacks and I thought I was, you know, needed to go to hospital and all these kinds of things, you know. And I'm sure, you know, more than ever, I feel like more people in society are going through this. We all feel like we're under so much pressure to be working harder, 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 harder. Funnily enough, after that happened, my route to recovery wasn't doing less. It was getting put on anti-anxiety pills and antidepressants. And I was at first thought, well, this is great because I can do as much as I did before, but I don't feel all the anxiety that I used to do. So now I'm just like an Iron Man machine kind of thing. But then, you know, a number of things happened. You know, you're not you anymore, mainly. Mm. You're numb, and it's at some point the physical toll takes over. You know, it's all too much. And so what I realized was that it was much better to not be on any medication like that. And every time I had those feelings to go, aha, my mind and my body are telling me that I'm doing too much. So it sounds really dumb, to be honest, that I had to go through all of that to realize that my body's got really good warning mechanisms, which means that if I get those feelings, I go, I am taking on too much. Hmm. And so then what I had to get really good at was two things. One is prioritizing. What do I really want? And not just tomorrow, but what do I really want in 10 years, in 15, 20 years from now? And therefore, what are the things I need to do every day or every month or every year to get to that place in 10 years? And therefore, if anything else comes along that isn't in line with that, then the second thing I had to do was learn how to say no. And this is also something that many people are really bad at. And I was the worst. I'm a very kind person. I always, you know, I like people to like me. And the easiest way is saying yes to everything. And I know that I can help people, lots of people, with lots of things. But nowadays, you got to say no to nearly all of them. And once you get good at the priorities that get you where you want to be and saying no to the things that are not on that path, then all of a sudden, your path to success is massively accelerated. And it's straight as an arrow rather than hopefully something will happen that gets me to where I want to be.
Your MO is experience. It's the experience of people who speak with you, who have interactions with you as a business person and as just a person and as a salesperson and as a business owner and as a designer and a UX person. Everything you have written about and everything that you do is geared towards elevating the experience of others in your presence. And I think that you teach other people how to do this well. And given what you just said with your journey, how you've determined your priorities and learned to say no and listening to your body, which is a tough thing to do because my mind is a different thing than my body. And I'm, you know, I'm 27 and I think I can do everything in the world. And I agree. Yeah. I have to listen to my body more. As you've gone through that journey, you are where you are. What impact does the clear path to success have for the experience that you give others? Can you kind of speak to the maybe the joy you see, or maybe even the more clarity that other people have when they're in your presence? How has this impacted your professional life that has garnered more success or helped you get to places you didn't know you think you could be?
That's an interesting question. I think I've always wanted to be clear with why I'm doing things. So we all want success in one way, shape, or form. We all want money and happiness, and the two aren't necessarily intrinsically linked, as we know. But I've always made a promise to myself that if I receive abundance, prosperity, success, whatever you want to call it, then I won't hoard it. I will be generous with it and help others, because that is why we're on earth, I think. I mean, no one really knows why we're on earth, but if it's not to help other people in alignment with doing what we want to do in our lives, then, you know, nothing seems better to me than that. So I love to mentor people. I love to teach people. I love to hear stories back when people have gone, oh, I've read your book and I did this pitch and it worked and this great thing happened. And I just think it just makes everything worthwhile. So I don't know whether that really answers your question, but I think everyone should be thinking about sharing any success you have with as many people as possible.
I think it does answer my question. And the best salespeople that I know, the people who in this industry that I look up to the most, are those who are more generous with what they have than I even thought people could be. And they invest in others any chance they get. And that means their customers. That means the people that they talk to, they give more than they try and take. And usually it's because they're in a sales role, but they just love having great conversations and solving problems. And they say no to things because they know they're not going to solve that problem. And they say yes to the right stuff because they believe in it and they know it's going to help others. And they're giving with their time and their effort. Danny, I appreciate you spending just a few minutes with us and walking through the psychology of storytelling and how you got to where you are and what success maybe looks like for people in your position and all the great insights that you have. I look forward to more conversations with you. Before I let you go, where can people find you? Where can people find a pitch and learn more from what you've got to offer?
It's been great coming back. I'd love to come back again. You can find the book Pitch, How to Captivate and Convince Any Audience on the Planet in anywhere you feel like buying a book from, pretty much. You can find me, Danny Fontaine, on LinkedIn. You can find me at pitchguy.co.uk as well. And you can find the Pitch Masters podcast at the same place you find a podcast.
All of those places. And if you are listening to this and you find his band's music somewhere, link it in the comments. I want to find it.
It's out there.
It's out there somewhere. So go find that. If you are listening to this, and you've gotten to this point, please give us a 5-star rating on Spotify, on Apple Music, and follow us and give us a like on YouTube. If you haven't watched our podcast in video, that's where we are, over on YouTube at Sales Gravy. You can always find us there. Danny, thank you so much for being on the Sales Gravy podcast, and we will catch you all next time.
Hi, I'm Jeb Blunt, bestselling author of Fanatical Prospecting, Sales EQ, Objections Inked, and my brand new book, The LinkedIn Edge. You know, companies and people from all over the world come to me to get answers to their toughest sales and growth questions. And that's why I created Ask Jeb. It's a segment on the Sales Gravy podcast where you can come and ask me anything. If you want to get on the show, just go to salesgravy.com/ask. That's salesgravy.com/ask. One of our great producers will get you on and you can ask me anything about sales.
Nooks brings prospecting, emailing, and parallel dialing into one single workflow. Their AI agents handle the busy work so your reps can focus on what matters, live conversations. Stop wasting up to 80% of the day stitching tools together and start hitting your numbers with Nooks. Go to nooks.ai to see how artificial intelligence plus human intelligence equals more pipeline. That's nooks.ai, N-O-O-K-S.ai.